I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without your essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. Man, I was just in Hawaii and I had my Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie with me. And here's the deal. We're in and out of the water all the time, getting in to go spearfishing, getting out, taking the kids to the beach. I'm not going to mess around all day putting sunscreen on, then having to get washed off. I just run a hoodie. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Meat Eater Podcast. We're going to talk now about something that is perhaps the least understood, in my opinion, realm of hunting and fishing in America, which is hunting mountain lions. Something that I've never done successfully. No thanks to the guy I'm sitting here with, Floyd Green. Before I get into that, I want to remind everyone, if you want to watch the show Meat Eater, not listen to the Meat Eater podcast, go to meateater.vhx.tv and you can download it and stream it to your heart's content. They sell them on there in like these blocks of episodes. And if you go on there and use the offer code MeatEaterPodcast, you get $5 off any volume. And there's a lot. How many volumes did you say around there yet?
Six.
Six volumes.
I think that's about 25% off. I think they're around $20.
Way huge discount. So MeatEater.vhx.tv, offer code MeatEaterPodcast. And while you're at it, go on to Yanni. Yannis Koutelis is joining us here. Go on to Yannis's thing,
website,
plug it. Go buy some of Giannis's Hunt to Eat t-shirts.
Hunt to Eat.
What's one of those good t-shirts cost, Giannis?
$24.95. Yeah. We usually can get a ship for just a couple dollars.
And if Yanni's out of stock like he always is, just keep checking bags. He'll buy two or three more and get them in stock.
That's right.
Okay, on to the subject of hunting mountain lions. I'm going to give my personal mountain lion resume. I've eaten 3 mountain lions, which is the same number of mountain lions that I've seen in the wild, though I haven't eaten any of the ones I've seen in the wild. I ate all separate ones. There's this place outside of Missoula, Montana called the Rock Creek Lodge, and every year they have something called the Testicle Festival, where they serve, there's this whole big, very hedonistic festival around serving deep fried nuts from castrated steers. They castrate steers in the spring, but it's in the fall. They must be freezing them.
Hope they keep well.
It seems like you do it around the time, right? But one time I was in there in the spring and there was a pot of pulled pork on the counter and they weren't selling it. It was free. And I made myself a sandwich and the guy told me that it was mountain lion. And he said, Rock Creek Lodge, balls in the fall, pussy in the spring. that was one of the 3 mountain lions I've eaten. Another mountain lion I ate, my old girlfriend was in line in the hardware store in Wyoming, and the guy in front of her was buying a mountain lion tag. And she said, what are you going to do with the mountain lion? He said, I just want the hide. She said, we'll take all the meat. And sure enough, this dude called about a week later and gave us the whole mountain lion. And we ate that thing every which way. It's not bad.
No, it's pretty good.
The back straps on it are where it's at.
Yeah, but it's all, you know, kind of a white meat that...
Yeah, surprising.
Resembles pork without the greasiness.
Yeah.
Pretty good stuff.
It'll test the strength of your jaw. Often. So I'm joining this conversation by a real, live, actual, very serious lion hunter, Floyd Green. Floyd owns, like, some things that you might be familiar with that I like to use and that you see often around wilderness athlete, outdoorsman's. But you've been a lion hunter longer than any of that stuff.
Yeah, I started hunting lions the first time with some guys, and I was a teenager, late teens, and I didn't have my own hounds till I was around 20. But
and you were born here. We're in Arizona right now, in Scottsdale, and you were born
here in Phoenix.
And what was the lion hunting culture then? Like, how did you get into it?
Well, I got into it actually up in Sholo, Arizona, up there building homes, and the guys were headed out one day, and I just tagged along with them. And I'd always had a lot of dogs and been around dogs my whole life.
What was the reason you had them?
I didn't have any lion hunting dogs then. I had one coon hound and one mutt. But after spending time with those guys and watching them work with their dogs, and, you know, the first time you see a lion climb a tree or you walk up to a tree and one is in it, it's just the bug either generally bites people that really enjoy that. And
yeah.
An amazing animal to be up close to like that.
And it's a dog thing largely, too.
Absolutely.
But we can get into that.
Absolutely. If it wasn't for watching the young dogs transform and all the planning that goes behind putting your pack of dogs together or breeding the next group of puppies, you know, just seeing lions get killed is certainly not why people hunt lions.
So how many years ago was it that you started hunting lions?
It'd be early 80s, like 81,
yeah.
You know, somewhere right around.
And then got your own dogs.
Right. And that was, I had a lot, you know, I had my own dogs within a year at that time, but they wasn't a very successful group of dogs at that point in my life. Just, had a lot more dogs than we had lion catching going on.
Yeah. What one thing that Floyd does, like there's, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but basically you would divide lion hunting into two categories. It's hunting them in the snow.
Right.
Is that fair?
It is. You know,
or hunting them in where there's no snow.
Well, hunting them in bare ground conditions is more challenging due to the fact that you rely on the dogs a lot more. So it takes a lot higher level of hound. You know, you're in the snow, you're going to drive the roads, look for where a lion's crossed in the snow. You can generally determine to some degree how old that track is, certainly can determine which way it's going. With the hounds, when you're riding along on your mule, or some guys do it off of a four-wheeler, however you may be doing it, and your dogs are free casting out in front of you, there's literally dozens of animals that they have the opportunity that they smell every step of the way. They're smelling some different creature.
Yeah.
And you're relying on them to let you know that they've crossed a lion's path. And you may go days before that happens in a lot of cases.
Yeah. My older half-brother was an elk guide in Colorado for many years. And he did some lion. He had a guy, one of his guides was a lion hunter. And they would just, you know, have clients who wanted to come out. And he would have a list of guys, and he wouldn't call the client until he found the track. And guys would, because he would have some guys like, you got to be ready to go at the drop of a hat, and he'd call, and a guy would like get on a plane and come up from Dallas or whatever.
And then they'd begin to hunt that one.
And then he'd go chase that lion.
And I don't, you know, in some parts of the country, there's just nobody even thinks about lion hunting until the snow falls.
Yep.
And part of that, you know, now with the wolves like they are, they can really determine whether there's wolves in the area or not also before they turn their...
Because the wolves will kill your dog.
Right. You know, those Canadian wolves are just a dangerous, you know, they're always a threat to the guys with hounds up there. And I don't know much about hunting in the northern part of our country, but what I see of it, it's, you know, snow hunting can be very, very challenging. It can be really, really tough physically. Some of the toughest hunts I've ever been on have been in the snow.
Just climbing around on snowy hillsides.
You know, go 15 miles in 2 foot of snow and in and out of the Grand Canyon a couple times. And, you know, it's just a tough, tough hunt on everybody.
But what the snow gives you, though. So when you go out and look for a lion, let's just set this up first so people get what we're talking about. When you go out and look for a lion, how old does the track have to be? Like, what's the oldest track you can run?
Most, you know, that's a highly controversial subject. I would say nobody's going to catch, you're going to catch very few lions that are over 6 to 8 hours. You're 6 to 8 hours behind them.
Okay. So step one of a lion hunt, just for listeners, like step one of a lion hunt would be that you're going into likely lion country or a place a lion is likely to pass through, and you're trying to find either through the nose of your dog or from tracks in the snow or tracks on the ground, you're trying to find a place where a mountain lion came through, walked through within the last 6 to 8 hours, ideally. I don't mean to harp on the snow thing too much, but it's just like it's just an interesting way to start thinking about some of the complexities of hunting lions, because if there's snow on the ground, you know how big the lion was.
Right. Generally, the species or the gender.
So you can tell that even.
Right. Most of the time.
And the best is you know what way it went.
Absolutely. We experienced that a time or two. It's, you know, knowing you're going the right way is 50% of the battle.
Yeah, because the dog, a famous thing people always say about, like, a good beagle is a beagle can zing back and forth on a rabbit track a couple of times, and he can tell relative freshness just on a short stretch, and he'll know what way the rabbit went. But with a lion, that's not, it takes him a little while longer to figure it out.
Well, and sometimes they the tendencies of the dog, well, a rabbit's a hot scent type track. Whereas a lion, I would consider a cold.
Well, you mean hot, like the rabbit just jumped up.
Just was there. So it's much more obvious to that beagle which way that track's going because it's dissipating.
I got you.
With a lion, that track may be laying there. You know, a lion, when it walks, it's offloading cells or spores, whatever you want to call them, that's what the dog is detecting. And for whatever reason, a lion leaves a scent longer than most animals. And it's different in the sense that, like with coon dogs, you know, coon dogs do the same thing as the beagles do on rabbits, and they almost generally figure out which way that coon's going and go the right way.
Gotcha.
Lion hounds, if I can't help them, then I let them make the decision. I don't ever try and outguess them, but I've sure gone the wrong way a lot of times.
How far away you go the wrong way?
Till the dogs become exhausted or the track burns out.
Exactly.
And I've gone, Chris, well, the day we caught your lion, this is a lion that's caught.
Floyd's talking to Chris Denham here, who hosts Western Hunter TV show and is a publisher. Publisher of Western Hunter, Elk Hunter magazines. And Chris has done a fair bit of lion hunting with Floyd.
We took a large male down in the Catalina Mountains, and after the lion was shot, Chris had shot the lion, one of our better dogs turned around and trailed that track, the one that was now dead, backwards till 6 o'clock that evening and probably went 12 miles from where we started.
Yeah, and back trailing the lion.
Back trip. You know, I mean, there was no question about what went on, you know. And we ended up catching up with her in Canada del Oro.
Yeah.
Almost to the bottom of it.
I shot him it was April 15th. I remember it was tax day. We shot him. It's a crazy, crazy story, but shot him within an hour of daylight. And we got to the bottom of Canyon del Oro and finally found that dog at dark and came pretty much out in the dark. And it was 14 hours probably. That dog was trailing back on that lion.
Yeah, because when we went out those couple of times and looking, even when the dogs would start running something, we were still spending a lot of time trying to find a track to verify what it was that they were after.
Right. You know, a lot of these dogs, all of my dogs now, lion numbers have dropped in the last 5 years, and all of my dogs have gotten to trailing bobcats, and they never used to do that. So now we have to determine, is it a bobcat or is it a lion? You know, and it's really hard to tell.
Why did your dogs start running bobcats?
Well, it's basically you would consider that a fault in a dog in a true bare ground lion hound, but almost all of them will at one time or another trail bobcats and foxes because you don't come across enough lion tracks to keep them You know, they're gonna trail something. You know, and it's very hard to tell the difference between the two unless you've got the soil or you find some way to find a track. As foxes and bobcats are everywhere, lions are here in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's always been something of a problem. But the good news is, typically fox and bobcat tracks, very similar to a coon or a rabbit, the track dissipates quickly. So typically,
the biggest, so your lead's going to run in the right direction,
right? And typically, if they don't go anywhere, that's a good sign that it's probably not a lion.
Oh, I got you.
If you start moving it out,
I see what you're saying. It's not going to like he's not going to they're not going to run an 8 hour old track for very long,
right?
Yeah,
right. Well, they won't run an 8 hour old bobcat track or fox track. They won't.
It's got to be fresh to get them interested
within probably 30 minutes or an hour.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What between all the hunting you've done, like just hunting lions with people, and then all the stuff you've done with biologists, treating them for research purposes and tranquilizing them and whatnot, how many lions have you run?
Run?
Or how many lions have you caught? Like lion guys use the word caught for a lion, whether you kill the lion or not.
Right.
Because the whole thing is catching it.
Right. After that, it's, you know, shooting them's kind of an anticlimactic end to the chase. The as far as lions I've caught, it's between 300 and 500. You know, it's always hard to put a number on that for me. A lot of them were caught with other hunters there and different circumstances and things like that. Some of them were lions that were caught multiple times and turned loose. You know, it's always challenging to figure out how to keep score. But there's been times in my life where we've caught as many as 25 lions a year for several years in a row, and there's other years you catch. You know, my goal is always to catch 10 a year, but there's been a few years we haven't got that done.
Is that right?
Yeah. So maybe when you think about doing it for 30 years, that adds up. It's a pretty substantial number. As far as lions that I've trailed, it'd be, you know, thousands.
Get incredible deals on premium cuts from ButcherBox. Do you like free protein for a whole year? Well, deals this good are hard to come by at the grocery store. I got two freezers, but you know what I'm saying. I like to have a freezer stocked full of stuff. I like feeling prepared, man. When I come home and it's time to make dinner, I like to go in. I got all my proteins lined up in there. Just makes me feel good about stuff. And with ButcherBox, you'll always be prepared with meat in the freezer. It means fewer trips to the grocery store. Delivered right to your doorstep with free shipping always. You get a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value. You'll get exclusive deals as a member, too. Sign up at butcherbox.com/meateater and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free-for-a-year offer plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free and every order for a year. So every box you get has that in it, free for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/meateater. Make sure you use code MEATEATER to choose your free for a year offer plus $20 off your first order. Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something. Because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER. I want to tell you about an American-made success story and Black Buffalo's award-winning nicotine pouches. Black Buffalo was built by dippers with decades of smokeless tobacco use. Black Buffalo is all about the history and tradition of dip, but they understand the convenience and discretion modern-day consumers are looking for. Black Buffalo's nicotine pouches give you the versatility to consume discreetly, but keep the ritual with flavors dippers love. mint, straight, and wintergreen, all proudly made right here in the USA. Tell them, Chili.
The reason I like Black Buffalo pouches is, one, they're very discreet. And what I mean by that is I can throw one in and almost forget it's there. And I prefer the mint pouches.
So if you're 21 or older, consume nicotine or tobacco, and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. You can order nicotine pouches online. They ship directly to most states, or check out their store locator to purchase pouches at thousands of retail locations around the country. Black Buffalo Tobacco Alternative, bold flavor, full pouches. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults age 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco.
How many dogs do you take out to hunt a lion?
I take as many as 13 at one time. I would prefer to take a half a dozen. That's an optimum number, 4 to 6. And I've caught a lot of lions with one dog. You know, you just, it's, but typically for a good fun hunt, the number I would pick would be 5 or 6. But a lot of times we'll take all 13 of them just to help keep them in shape.
Just to exercise them?
Yeah, so much about catching a lion has as much to do with the physical ability of the hound to persevere through a whole day of trailing and then jump the lion and actually put enough pressure on it to get it to climb a tree. So if they're not in good physical shape and their feet aren't tough and they can't go, they got to be able to go 10, 12 hours.
So lay out for me how a successful lion hunt goes. You get up in the morning and like, what? I know each time is different, but just like, how might a hunt go?
Well, Chris's, yours is a classic. The one we were just talking about. We got up in the morning and saddled the mules and rode up the very first.
So you prefer to hunt out on a mule?
Yeah, that'd be my preference by far.
So you're mounted, dogs running all around.
And I can stay with my dogs a lot better. As good a shape as you feel like you are, it's hard after a few days to physically stay with them on foot on a regular basis.
We covered an enormous amount of ground, I felt, when I was out with you.
I never hunted with a group of guys that was physically in the shape that you guys were when we went. Joe and I were both absolutely amazed every night when we came in, and all the guys running the cameras, I mean, and running them backwards up the hills and super tough country. It was amazing. And normally guys just don't show up in that kind of physical condition. And we did go a long ways. I mean, there was a couple times we trailed lions and I was sure we had the one caught.
Yeah.
And we didn't. But that would have been that's a typical, although Joe started that one early for us, it was, the distance wasn't unusual, to go.
Do their collars, like the GPS, does it keep a track of the distance they run?
Oh, yeah.
These dogs look like satellites, man. They got like 3 collars on, wires and stuff coming
off. So what's an average day that the dog puts on?
Well, the dog's a minimum on an average day is 20 miles. So, and I've seen 5 mile days. That's right. not a crazy deal either. But what gets tough is that's not hard for a good conditioned hound to do on any given day. It's hard for that dog to do day after day after day. Mm. And that's where you see professional lion hunters, guys that are guiding full time, or some of our government lion hunters. That gets to be the difference between them and sport hunters, is the condition of their dogs. Quality of the dogs, obviously, but the condition is huge. Where they can pursue a lion, they may trail a lion for 3 days before they overtake it and actually jump it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying they're stopping the track and picking it up each day, but every day you learn more about that animal and you're getting closer to it. You're getting into a tighter area where it may be. Well, on that third day, if you've been running...
Like you're saying 3 days in a row, you might pick up where that lion was the night before.
Absolutely.
As he's hunting an area.
Well, you won't pick up the exact spot, but you know, the lion's traveling to the south. We've trailed him 4 miles in that direction down this drainage. We'll try and loop ahead of him and pick him up again. And typically with good broke dogs, when you cross his track, they'll let you know, verify the direction and go again. Mm-hmm. Sooner or later, that lion's going to kill something or he's going to lay up somewhere. And that's when you'll overtake him.
Once he gets a belly full, was that because he's stopping to eat? Or because he's just hungry, because he's full and doesn't run as good?
No, it's because he stopped traveling.
Oh, okay.
He just finally, because
then he's camped out on the carcass and he's there for a while.
And so I think this is an important point, because I think I was like under the wrong impression too, because I always, everybody, or in my head, it's like you start out and it's like as soon as you're onto a track, you're like dogs are chasing this lion. But it's not that way. This lion is just out and about doing its thing for maybe 3 or 4 days, and eventually your hounds just catch up to it.
Right.
And for those dogs never got close.
And it seems so exciting because those hounds are so excited and they're bawling and carrying on that you feel like you're the lion's up and running from you.
But that cat might not even know about you and your dog.
Absolutely. That's a more often than not when you're trailing a lion. There was only one instance that I thought maybe we had a lion jumped, and that was that large Tom in the Galeros.
Yeah.
And I believe he outran us. I think that lion left the country. Almost every other lion, those lions probably never knew we were even in the vicinity.
Yeah, I think my lion was a classic, as we were riding. It was the third day, and we had done the same loop the first 2 days. And it, you know, probably a 15, 18-mile loop. You know, just
through life and country.
Yeah, just in working the same, you know, the same trails and just kind of working out old tracks. And the third day we left camp and we weren't, a mile from camp? And all of a sudden the dog struck, and struck hard. And we'd been through that exact canyon the 2 days previous. We knew that lion track wasn't there 2 days before, so we knew, you know, this is fresh.
So you knew that the lion had walked, you were sleeping and a lion passed through a mile from where you were sleeping.
Yeah.
Right.
So then what happened on that hunt?
Oh, it got pretty crazy after that. But we're right in the bottom of a canyon, and in the dogs kept trying to, they were going back and forth, and we found to find a scratch and figured out the scratch was saying the lion was going up the canyon.
Yeah, back up and explain what you mean by that.
Oh, with the lions will scratch. Floyd can explain a little more about what a scratch is, but where they're marking their territory, the toms, and they use their front feet, and they pull the soil up over top of where they've urinated, and they create it's just a pile of leaf litter or whatever. It's in the bottom of that little canyon, and you can see it from a good distance. It's usually like maybe 6-10 inches long.
And like in likely little places, like you can anticipate. Like when we were out, we kept looking at it. After a while, I'd be like, "That's a place where he would do that."
Yeah,
you know, like where two you're in a canyon and a tributary comes in. It was like a leafy area or something, you know,
big pine trees.
Yeah. And so we knew this, we figured the lions, we know that from the direction of the scratch, he's probably going up the canyon, but the dogs keep trying to, they go up and then they turn around, they want to come back. They want to keep wanting to come back. And finally, one dog went up and around us to get around us because we're trying to pull the dogs and push them the other direction. And then all of a sudden he struck, and we figured out afterwards that we probably literally jumped that lion out of that canyon.
Oh.
And he went, he scratched and then went right up and over the top. And so anyways, we got up over the top, and do you want me to tell the whole story?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a pretty good story.
No, it is, because this is explaining how a lion hunt goes.
Yeah. So
keep in mind miles here so people can get a perspective of like the scale.
Okay. This one actually happened pretty quick in a short amount of time, but so that we know the lion went up and over top this ridge, maybe a 300-400 foot elevation, half mile over the top. And we got up to the top and we can hear the dogs barking down the bottom, but it's kind of crazy barking. And Floyd split off to get a little bit different angle, and I stayed with the mules. And Floyd calls me. You can hear the dogs barking down there, and Floyd calls me on the radio and he says, "Chris, this lion's coming right to you. Get off." You know, so I jump off my mule and I get my pistol out, and I'm standing there like, you know, with my pistol out in front of me, just waiting for a lion to come up. Anyways, another dog came up there, and all of a sudden that lion took off and went back down and back into the other hounds. And
but you can see this happen.
No, Floyd can see this happen, and I can't see this. So he bails down to where the dogs are, and I'm just kind of standing up on top of the mules, just waiting for Floyd to tell me what the heck's going on. And all of a sudden, I just hear this voice down in the bottom of the canyon, and we would go from R-rated to X-rated if I actually told you everything he was yelling at me. But it was like, "Chris, get your ass down here!" I can just hear him just yelling at me. And I got a radio in my hand.
In the part that, Chris, just for everybody listening, that this lion is very unusual. It has gone by about 50 trees that it could have gone in, from oak trees to juniper trees, and it's fighting the dogs on the ground, which is really unusual for a mountain lion. And it's fighting them like a jaguar or a bear would fight them. And it's winning. I mean, it's mucking them out. And we stapled and stitched dogs for hours after this whole program. But
Floyd's getting to see this.
I was wanting Chris to hurry down there.
Yeah. So he's seeing all this, and I'm trying to piece it all together in my head. So I go bailing off the ridge, you know, down to where all the screaming's coming from. And I've got chaps on that are too long for me. I'm stumbling and falling, and I get there, and there's a big oak tree in the very bottom below me, and there's a bluff I'm standing on top of. And right underneath the oak tree, I can see just a muck of dogs and Floyd screaming and the lion screaming and on the ground. I mean, they're
perfectly good tree there.
Yeah, perfectly under a huge, perfect tree. So I kind of jump off that little bluff through the tree, and I land on the ground, and I get there, and there's a washout underneath the tree, and that washout's filled up with oak leaves, and all I can see is Floyd with a big stick in his hand in the bottom of this washed out oak leaf like pool, and Floyd's got this big huge stick in his hand, and one end is the lion's hanging onto one end, and there's dogs just jumping in, and this lion's just got paws going everywhere, claws going everywhere, and with a stick in his mouth. And, you know, Floyd's yelling at me, shoot him, shoot him. So I go sliding in the hole, and I have my pistol in my hand, and I'm literally from me to your foot, like 3 feet from the lion. And dogs are jumping in there, and I'm trying to grab dogs to get a clear shot. And Floyd, meanwhile, is covering his face because he knows the bullet's going to create some kind of splash. We're all so close. Meanwhile, the stick's broken off between his hands. So now he's down to two hands hanging onto the stick like a fishing rod with a big, you know, with a sailfish on the end. And I shoot the lion through the shoulder, and from 3 feet, there's no way I missed. And Floyd uncovers his eyes, and he looks at the lion. He looks at me, and the lion's still doing the same thing he was doing before I shot him. So he yells at me, shoot him again. So I shoot him again, and then finally the lights go out, and you know, on the lion, he's just dead. And you know, the dogs are piling in there, and I mean, it was just utter complete chaos. But what had happened is they with those oak leaves in that pool, nobody could get any traction to get out of there. And tell what happened with your pistol.
Well, Chris wanted to shoot the lion. I didn't want to shoot it and use my tag. But when I looked down in there, it was just all the dogs were getting killed. I mean, this lion was grabbing one. It wasn't, if there hadn't been a group of those dogs there, that he would have surely killed numerous dogs.
Yeah.
And he was big. He was one of the few 160-pound lions that I've caught in my life. And I mean, it was a big, big male that just didn't have any fear of us or the hounds or anything else. Anyhow, when I slid down in there, I had my pistol in my hand and just, you know, you're sliding. I jammed it into the dirt, and I just didn't want to, you know, I didn't know if it was full of dirt or not.
Yeah, you don't want to shoot it.
And I had that stick with me. Typically, when lions are wounded, they'll bite down on a stick like that. I never really had to deal with one that wasn't wounded before, but it did the same thing. And Chris got there about the same time it bit down on the stick, but that's what I was using to beat the dogs and it back, trying to get them separated.
Oh, I got you.
And that's how the stick got in its mouth.
So do you lose a lot of dogs to lions?
No. Typically you lose them to the bluffs, you know, and falling off of things more than lions. This last year we had a dog, another lion similar to Chris's that, you know, busted the skull on one dog's head and had another one in his skull, you know, the hound's head in its mouth, and I shot it. But, you know, it would have killed some dogs. But I've only lost maybe four or five over 30 years directly to a lion like that.
Getting them.
Right. Yeah.
I think this was you that I asked this one time. I was asking you if you ever have any problem, like when you're bringing in dogs that have been tore up by lions, if the vets ever frown on you. And I think you told me you went and found a vet who likes to hunt lions.
Well, he's retired now, but yeah, we have a local vet here in town and there's a couple of them that are lion hunters, and
so they understand.
They understand. Yeah, yeah. They're good about it. And even the clinic we use now, I would, you know, they're certainly not what I would consider hunting oriented or anything like that, and they're always there for us. But there are a lot of people that frown on it. You know, I remember one time I went into an emergency clinic with one of my hounds, and it had a gastric torsion where its stomach had turned. it was a great dog, and I was really worried about losing it. And this pudgy little veterinarian told me that the dog, she did, obviously didn't believe in hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me she was going to turn me into the Humane Society or the Sheriff's Department for mistreatment of animals, and because my dog was in such poor shape physically. And she was probably 50 pounds overweight. And I pointed out to her that she didn't see any fat people winning the Olympics either. and of course, that didn't help our relationship. They did save the dog. But yeah, every once in a while, you get into those clinics and you run into that. There's a lot of people that disapprove of lion, you know, hunting with hounds, and they think that it's unfair to hunt lions.
Oh, all the time. It's like one of the lion hunts, one of the things that when anti-hunting groups, anti-hunting money, Humane Society, a lot of the money comes from other organizations. When they look at what they can go after, that's one of the things they go after. Like, I remember reading this thing where it was a series of polls on acceptance of hunting. And I remember reading one in Arizona where if you just asked people, do you support, you know, a person's right to hunt? Okay. And it was surprising to me. I can't remember exactly, but it was somewhere on the lines of like, you know, like 74-75% of people supported it. But anytime you ask them a specific thing, the acceptance rate would go down. So people like the idea, but you say like, okay, how about, you know, hunting, like bow hunting? Much less. Okay. No matter what specific inquiry you put to them, it was always like less people approved of the specific than it did the concept. And when you want to go after something, you can make the case pretty easy, and they've done it effectively in several states now. You can make the case pretty easily that it's real bad to hunt lions with dogs.
Absolutely. We've lost it in Washington, California, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand why. Like, I guess I kind of get what they're thinking, but I think that they're thinking that the dogs are doing all the work, or I don't, like, what is the, have you ever gotten a sense in your...
Well, it's, you know, I always kind of, it's always tough for me to approach those people. Whenever people have a strong opinion about something that they have no knowledge about, you got to almost assume that you're dealing with an idiot.
Yeah.
So at that point, the discussion for me becomes hard to engage. And I'll sit down with some people and talk to them about it. But the one thing I always tell people is, you know, in my life that, you know, I learned to fly a helicopter in 30 days. Can run multiple businesses. Everything is relatively easy compared to getting up in the morning and saying, oh, I'm going to go catch a mountain lion today. So it's really insulting when somebody says it's not sportsmanlike or it's unfair because they have they haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at that and you think about that being put to a ballot or an initiative, I can make the case. You know, lions are probably the most noble creature in the woods, probably certainly one of the most beautiful. And when people look at that, they say, how could you go kill that animal? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in wildlife management, all animals have to be managed. You don't get to pick and choose which ones you do or don't manage. So I get really, you know, I understand how they make the case. I could probably do a lot better job than they do. But it's mostly they don't understand how sporting it is.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it used to be the sport of kings, chasing hounds, and it was chasing foxes in England.
Yeah, a thing that I find works for people, or it's like it's helpful when you're like sort of conceptualizing what kind of hunting is acceptable or not acceptable or likely to be shot down in a public battle or not. I'm stumbling around this, but there's like a sort of a thing like a traditional use, okay? So in areas where people have traditionally hunted lions with dogs, I would tend to think, and I think most people agree, that you would continue doing what was traditional. So if you had an area, like there's states where you've never been able to set out bait for black bears, okay? Like you can't bait black bears in Montana, for instance. It's been like that for a long time now. I'm not like a... pressing, you know, I'm not encouraging someone to legalize baiting bears in Montana because the way it was set from a wildlife management issue. It was set from a traditional use issue, and they have a system that works, you know. But it's like when you start taking away traditional use practices, that's more upsetting to me, and that like makes me more suspicious than preventing new practices from entering the realm.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that like comes up all the time. Like when guys down south, like for me, like I grew up in the upper Midwest. No one hunts deer with dogs. If you went and said, we're going to start a new rule, you can hunt deer with dogs, people, particularly deer hunters, would be up in arms. Okay. They'd be like burning buildings down over this. Meanwhile, you can hunt deer with dogs in the southeast, many states. It's just what they've done. You know, and you have to kind of respect traditional use practices, I think. And the thing with lions is because the way lions behave when they're active, how they travel, you can kill them with predator calls, kind of. Now and then a guy will run into one and shoot it. But it's like you hunt lions with dogs. To stop dog hunting for lions, you're basically saying you can't hunt lions.
Correct.
Basically. And I know, like, in South Dakota, like, guys call them in a little bit, you know.
Well, we just got the data back for our 2014 harvest here, and I believe there was 200, and these are round numbers, but 270 lions harvested, and at least 230 of those were with the aid of hounds.
Is that right?
You know, and I say 230, maybe it's just over 220, 230, somewhere in there. But basically, when you remove hound hunting from the scope of wildlife management, hunting lions with hounds from the scope of wildlife management, you've effectively removed your ability to manage lions, whether it's to the benefit of sheep or deer or any other prey species. So now, California is a great example. Go to California and try and find a deer.
Yeah. They thought they had a lion hunting problem. Now they got a lion problem.
And right now we're seeing a decline in the lion numbers in the western states, at least in the states I'm familiar with, which are Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, and Arizona. Lion numbers are far lower now than they were 5 years ago. And we've got, you know, I'd hate to guess, I'd say that there's a third to half the lions that we had 5 to 10 years ago. But it really doesn't have anything to do with hunting pressure. It has more to do with the cyclic following prey bases, and everything cycles. And all wildlife animal or species do. But they're definitely down now. It's one of the things we've encountered, like when we were on the...
That's weird because they're having like outside of this area, they're experiencing an expansion of range.
Right. Right.
Like expanding. Yeah, expanding into more urban areas, expanding into states that you have traditionally not had them.
And I would question too whether those states have or haven't had them.
Everywhere has had them.
Yeah. Well, but the advent of trail cameras have given us a lot more documentation. You know, there's always been claims of lions in Maine.
Yeah.
And everybody thought, you know, somebody was just seeing things. But now with trail cameras, you know, it's obviously a much more documented situation. And they are, and I do believe they are expanding the range. A very dynamic, very healthy population of lions in the United States.
Yeah, and that expansion's a lot less if you take out young males. Like, if you were to draw a map of where females were showing up, that map's not nearly as big as where males are showing up. So a lot of times when you find these, when these lions are coming out of the eastern U.S., and people used to say, like, oh, it's a runaway pet. You'd be like, there's a hell of a lot of people with mountain lion pets. At this point. Pets. But now they're finding, you know, that these are like these male mountain lions that are traveling several states over, coming out of the Black Hills, you know, turning up in crazy places.
And researchers term those as transient lions, and they're almost always males. And males tend to be the ones that get in the most trouble. A friend of mine that works for the government is, I think it was 500 lions were removed in a, I forget how many year period of time, but the vast majority of them were males.
Yeah.
And that's typically what you see. They're the ones that get in the most trouble.
Do you tree more males and females?
They're easier to tree. And I would say, yes, we do.
Why are they easier to tree?
You know, they leave more scent. They travel the country. The example I always use is a guy going into a store and buying something. He goes in and he gets what he wants and he comes back, he's gone. He's straight line in, straight line out. You send your girlfriend or your wife in there, she might be in there an hour to do this, get the same thing and wander all over the damn store. That's how female lions are. So it makes them much more challenging to trail, and they leave less scent.
Gotcha.
So they, you know, it's just, the males are generally much, like in the case of Chris's lion that day, that son of a gun came right straight down that canyon for 2 or 3 miles.
Yeah.
You know, when we were going backwards trying to find the dog, we saw every place that he scratched and every mark that he made along there. By the way, I'd say they use their hind feet most of the time.
It is hind feet.
Yeah. That's always been, but there's an awful lot of pictures on trail cameras now of them using the hind feet. and they use both. But sometimes they use their front feet too.
You know, there's a story, I know I told you this in the past, Floyd, where in the 1930s in Florida, it was generally accepted that the Florida panther was gone. You know, there was rumors of sightings in the same way that now they could take some state like Missouri or something where like now and then a guy will see one. Everybody tells him he's crazy, right? That was the situation in Florida. But there was some guys who just knew they were there. And there's a story where a guy, somewhere in the early 30s, I think it was, he got in touch with some houndsmen in Arizona. And they came out and within a couple weeks had killed 7 lions in Florida. At which point people said, okay, we get the point. And like the guy was just basically saying, stop telling me there's no lions in Florida.
And I don't remember who the lion hunter was, but that could have been one of the Lee brothers or any number of, you know, there was a lot of famous lion hunters.
I went and reread it because you had mentioned there were some famous lion guys. I went and reread it. He doesn't name the name of the guy that came.
Well, a man out of Texas, his name, and there's a whole family of them, the McBrides, and Roy McBride is the one that, I don't remember where, maybe out of Texas, that they took lions back to Florida and infused them into that population. Yeah. And hope to help bring it back around and some fresh genetics in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's been a dynamic population down there now, and it seems like they've got a very healthy population.
Yeah, it's doing better now. And it was a funny thing because when we talk about mountain lions, we're talking about, there's so many names. So mountain lion, cougar, puma or puma, catamount.
Catamount. That's one you don't hear very often.
Yeah. I mean, that was like a older term in the East primarily was catamount. It's all the same thing. And so, like, again, like, you go back to the time of European contact, these things were everywhere.
Right.
You know?
Coast to coast.
Yeah, there was no real division. So there was probably no genetic barrier, really, when you factor, like, how much they could travel, how many places they were. There was probably no genetic barrier between the ones in Florida and the ones in Washington State. There's just lions, you know? When the lion population in Florida got so low, people made an argument that they were talking like a subspecies, and it's this constant, like, in biology, you have this constant like lumping and splitting, but people were arguing that you had this like subspecies in Florida, and that it would damage it somehow to bring, you know, blood in from somewhere else, but they did.
Yeah, and you know, literally every mountain range can have its own subspecies if you get carried away, just because the animals may or may not ever travel out of that. And they have the same kind of thing. They called it the Yuma Puma here in Arizona. And you know, all it was a lion that was geographically isolated, just like the Florida panther. And at that point, they will take on their own genetic characteristics, but they're still all mountain lions.
Yeah, and those things in Florida were having, they needed genetic diversity brought in so bad, they were like, their tails were shaped wrong, and just all kinds of problems.
It's too much inbreeding.
And it was a funny thing, because like, you look at people who argue in favor of the existence of Bigfoot, okay, that you've had, you know, like people say, there's Bigfoots in the UP, you have Bigfoots in California, Bigfoots in Washington, Bigfoots in Oregon, so you got a sizable population. You must, right?
They're everywhere.
And they've been here continuously now since, people would argue, before the arrival of Native Americans across the Bering Land Bridge. No one's hit one with a car yet.
No one has a trail cam, but well.
But in Florida, just like the dead on the street thing, okay? In Florida, at a point, they were down to a known like 47 or 50 mountain lions in Florida. And every year, they're losing multiple cats to getting hit. by cars. And this is in the Everglades.
Very hard.
Where there's not a huge abundance of roads. And you got 50 of a species and you're hitting several a year with cars. That to me is the greatest argument against the existence of Bigfoot. If you could be hitting like a significant percentage of mountain lions with cars every year, but no one's run into one of these things.
Yeah.
A real one. It's always like, it's like a real dead one that we can just show around.
I run into people occasionally that actually believe that there is, you know, I mean, I have two in my life that I can think of that were dead serious about it. And it generally goes back to an experience they had out in the woods where they saw something that they thought was Bigfoot. But I spent 30 years of my life riding through the state of Arizona staring at the ground. I've never seen anything that even came close to looking like Bigfoot.
Well, this isn't Bigfoot country.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably true. We don't have a lot of sightings here.
Yeah, yeah. What is some of the work you've done with going out with government people or biologists or whatever to, like, get lions?
Well, the bulk of it is probably the late 80s. I haven't done much in the last 10 or 15 years, but it would be the studies over by Wickenburg and over in that area in the desert country and from Wiki up and all through the western portion of our state over there.
And what do? They hire you just to put lions into trees?
Yeah, well, it was hired in one case and then in the others generally volunteering my time because it was all, typically the biologists were friends of mine and people like that that knew us. But in those places, you almost always put them up in a rock, you know, on a bluff. And they'd dart them, put a collar on them. And then a lot of times we'd have to go back out and change collars. You know, back in those days, the telemetric systems weren't what they are today. And we certainly didn't have any satellite stuff. So it was all, they would change them. Which, you know, those lions get to be pretty savvy after you have to do that with them a couple times.
Because, like, if a lion trees once and gets caught, he's less likely to tree again the second time.
Right. He's darn sure not going to tree as easily, typically. I say that the females seem to be worse than the males, but... you know, Julie and I this year had a male lion that, we started the track in the morning at 6 or 7 in the morning and went from Arizona to New Mexico, 8 miles as the crow flies, air miles, 8 miles. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the lion was across a canyon from us, the actual Mule Creek Canyon drainage. And we could see the lion. It was laying on the side of the rim looking back, watching the dogs come. And that turned into a second pack of dogs in that process. So that lion wasn't going to be caught. And then we saw it twice that day.
You never caught it?
Never caught it. In fact, the second time we saw it, I called a friend of mine that owned the ranch, and he came and got on the track with the lions and the dogs. And, you know, we ended up getting caught up with him and getting the hounds stopped. But that lion, I doubt that lion will ever be caught by hounds. And it's obviously learned that. That's a learning.
Because he's just not going to go into a tree.
Right. And what they do is they get out in front of the dog. In that case, he would get about, I'd say it was a half mile. He started moving again. And they start trotting. And for whatever reason, typically there's a lot of different theories behind it. But a lion that is trotting or running is much harder for a dog to trail if the scent has landed on the ground. If the scent's still floating in the air and the hound can take it out of the air, it can really put some pressure on an animal.
Mm.
But as soon as that scent that's in the air dissipates, the dog has to go back to smelling it on the ground. And now the scent and the spores that were very evenly laid because the lion was casually walking are now in bounded piles where it's landing, if it's jumping, or even when it's trotting, it's just dispersing those cells elsewhere for it. So it makes it harder for him to trail it.
Yeah.
And there again, that's when it comes into the case. If the dogs are in good enough shape, I thought mine were in really good shape at that time, but there are guys that hunt that do it professionally, that their dogs might have been in better shape and put more pressure on that cat and made it climb a tree.
Yeah.
But it was a long day.
So when you saw that lion across the canyon, what do you mean? You just looked over and there he was?
Julie saw it and she wanted me to shoot it. And I, of course, I had a pistol and I told her, I said, I wasn't going to be able to shoot it, and she filmed it over there laying under the tree, and it did its mouth hanging wide open. It's
like, how many yards away?
150, 175. It's one of those, it's just, you know, real abrupt, bluffy canyon.
And then you saw it get back up and start going?
Right.
as the dogs closed in.
And it laid down under a big pine tree. It was interesting to watch this. The dogs, there was three dogs coming. And we knew, you know, they're all, we knew which dogs they were, and they were coming fast. When they got to the tree, they thought the lion had gone up the tree because the scent was so strong.
Oh, yeah.
So they fooled around there for another 5 minutes or so while the lion's just getting farther ahead and going and going.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it got ahead of, and now the hounds never quit going. So, you know, the lion's doing this where it's running for a while, and then it'll go through a really rough spot and then take a break.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it was, they're a lot smarter than people think they are. That's, you know, there's a lot of people that'll make the case that a cat's IQ is greater than that of a dog. And I never really thought that most of my life, but, you know, some of these experiences like that really make you think about it.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER. I want to tell you about an American-made success story and Black Buffalo's award-winning nicotine pouches. Black Buffalo was built by dippers with decades of smokeless tobacco use. Black Buffalo is all about the history and tradition of dip, but they understand the convenience and discretion modern-day consumers are looking for. Black Buffalo's nicotine pouches give you the versatility to consume discreetly, but keep the ritual with flavors dippers love. Mint, straight, and wintergreen, all proudly made right here in the USA. Tell them, Chili.
The reason I like Black Buffalo pouches is, one, they're very discreet. And what I mean by that is I can throw one in and almost forget it's there. And I prefer the mint pouches.
So if you're 21 or older, consume nicotine or tobacco and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. You can order nicotine pouches online. They ship directly to most states, or check out their store locator to purchase pouches at thousands of retail locations around the country. Black Buffalo Tobacco Alternative, bold flavor, full pouches. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults age 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco. Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? And you probably got rain gear, but you shouldn't overlook sunny day gear. Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite Hoodie has you covered on the sunniest day. Man, I was just in Hawaii and I had my Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite Hoodie with me. And here's the deal. We're in and out of the water all the time, getting in to go spearfishing, getting out, taking the kids to the beach. I'm not going to mess around all day putting sunscreen on, then having to get washed off. I just run a hoodie. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50, and it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head on over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all of their performance fishing gear.
Have you encountered, let me get back to the biology thing. So you guys would go out and catch them with the collar on them. Does that make it super easy to catch a lion when you got a telemetry deal?
Yes. Typically when you do that,
you just know where he is and when he's there.
Right. Right. It's, you know, half of the hunt is trying to locate a track a lot of times.
I got you.
And, you know, once you locate the track, then you start trailing the lion. And, we're, you know, really when you have the collar on a lion like that, you're going to a spot to to catch the lion.
No, I'm with you.
With fresh dogs, and so it's a lot different.
So what happens between when you run the lion and the lion doesn't know you're after him? He's just going about his business. When you say jump a lion, what happens when they jump the lion? That just means the lion is now aware of dogs.
That means we've come to the place, you know, the lions, they travel a great deal early afternoon, late evening, and then again they travel some in the morning, but most of their traveling starts about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and then probably 8, 9 o'clock that, you know, they're either laying up somewhere, or I've learned a lot from people's trail cam photos. They just don't travel as much as I thought they traveled all night, and they don't. It seems like the sweet spot for them is that early evening stuff. So if you started to track
like daylight hours,
right?
So most are traveling is daylight hours.
That gray light type stuff.
Yeah.
And you're liable to see them at any time. But the evening, early evening, and in that, you know, 8, 9 o'clock seems to be the time that they do most of their hunting. So if you're picking up on one of those tracks, you're now, say you hit it at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, you're 12 hours behind this thing. So it's going to be a grind. And if it's a male and the conditions are right, like this time of year, those males put off a lot more scent and the trailing conditions are a lot better than, say, if it was in September or in October.
Gotcha.
But when you know, the dogs are barking and trailing, doing 100 miles of what we did together. When they get to where that lion's laid up, that lion jumps and runs. Now that track's very fresh. And a lot of times they're taking it out of the air. They'll be chasing that lion, and it just, you can tell the dogs have jumped it. It just, the intensity and their excitement, and some dogs that may not have barked all day will all of a sudden be joining in. And that's when you know they've jumped the lion, and that's when the race is on. And sometimes it'll just last to the bottom of the canyon, and then sometimes it may be a mile, but it generally is, typically, a normal lion, it would be over. That's, you know, you would expect to get it caught at that point.
And when he's getting caught, what's he usually going into? Trees or rock piles?
In Arizona, we probably catch them 50% of them in the rocks.
Hmm. Do they go into holes?
Oh yeah, mine shafts, all kinds of. And it's, I think that cats just wander through their domain throughout time because they seem to find the craziest places to go get in, and they also seem to know how to get out of them. And we, Dave Martin's lion, the fellow that puts the rim to rim on this year, a lion, Joe Mitchell, called and said, you know, we're coming your way. And anyhow, when he actually saw the lion get up and go in the rock pile. He was above us. And we hiked up to where the rock pile was, and Dave and Joe were standing on one side of the rock pile, and I watched the lion come out the other side. And when I say a rock pile, it's probably a 75-yard long pile of boulders.
Mm-hmm.
And that lion traveled through that maze of boulders and come out somehow on our side. And fortunately for all of us that were hunting the lion, I had dogs with me and saw it. And then we got Joe's dogs over there and managed to get it in a tree. But, you know, that lion, that's how smart they are.
Like underground passageway.
Yeah, it had an underground passageway. And the lion had gotten away the week before doing something similar to that.
Oh, okay.
You know, but they're cats. You know, they probably spend their lifetime prowling around in that mountain, investigating all those nooks and crannies and that kind of thing.
I was hunting.
How often can I, how often can you jump on like that and be on like a hot track where you're like the chase is on, but then you don't get them treed?
You know, it's happened once this year, you know, out of a dozen lions.
Half a dozen.
Yeah. So it typically, when they jump a lion, you should catch it. But you just never know. It's, you know, that's kind of what makes it exciting now. And the lions have definitely this, you know, as the numbers of lions decrease, the lions that are in existence are just smarter. Mm-hmm. Genetically, you know, whether it's a genetic thing or a learned trait from having been hunted or whatever it may be, they certainly seem to be jumping and running, and they're evolving more in that sense.
Yeah.
I have a dog out in the backyard. You haven't seen Steve. That's a friend of mine out of Wisconsin helped me acquire. They call them lurchers, but it's half border collie and half staghound. And his only job is to handle those kinds of things. And he's just a physical specimen as far as an animal that super high intelligence and unbelievable physical ability.
And he just meant to handle a jumped lion.
Right. Jumped lions, lions that that do things that the hounds typically, if one jumps and they're looking at it, they handle that very well. But this dog would be more along the lines of, with his intelligence and the fact that he isn't a trail hound, when he thinks we might be getting close to a place where we're going to jump a lion, he gets out and he spends a lot of time doing things that the hounds aren't doing, trying to get the jump on that lion.
Is that right?
Oh, he's kind of like just kicks up the intensity just a little bit. And
right. He doesn't even normally leave us until he thinks they might be getting close to catching it. And then all of a sudden he'll just disappear. But he, and I don't know, I mean, I never am there right when it happens, but I feel like he has definitely helped. I know that he helps when they jump in the tree jump type stuff. He doesn't really do a lot of things like a hound does, but he never quits looking at them. And, you know, when like that lion hits, and he's only seen maybe 10 or 15 lions now. When that lion heads out to a tree limb, he looks like he's trying to catch a pop fly. You know, I mean, he's right there trying. He knows what he's going to do. Yeah. And he's, you know, he's anticipating it the whole way.
Yeah. And your dogs might be oblivious to the fact that the lion's leaving the tree.
Yeah, no, they, some are, but most of them kind of get that. But they tend to be more reactive. And the border collie in him is, you can see the intelligence factor there.
Yeah. You know, you were talking about that lion going underground, you know, and coming out on our spot. We were hunting pigs, wild pigs in New Zealand with dogs, and the guy had the GPS collars on the dogs. And all of a sudden his dogs just vanish off of his, he's not getting on his unit, he's not getting their signal anymore. And we start going in the direction we'd last heard them. And then now and then it'd be like, it'd pop, the dog would pop up. One of the dogs would be like, oh, there it is. But then it'd go away. And it was because this pig had gone down into a tunnel.
The dogs went in.
It wasn't getting satellite reception anymore on his collar. But then the pig wound up getting stuck in the tunnel. So the dogs are just down there holding on to the pig's tail. And no one's coming out of that hole.
Wow.
So we wound up digging a shaft down to the pig and pulled it up with dogs still hanging off it. On the other end, like the dogs were just never going to give up.
Yeah, no, they,
you know,
that's generally your best dogs, you know, the ones that quit early and all that. Those are the ones that you probably wonder if you shouldn't find them a good home. But those that, and unfortunately, those a lot of times are the dogs that get killed because they jump off bluffs after their quarry or whatever it may be. But those are the good ones.
Yeah. It's kind of funny you talk about, it's like we have such a weird relationship with dogs in this country where on some level we want to bestow on them like human characteristics, you know, and that they have almost like human rights. But then how can you then tell the dog that he shouldn't want to hunt lions?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like an honest question I always think about is if you really are, like, let's say you're like adamant, you know, you're a vegan, right? Do you think that wolves should stop killing?
Well,
I mean, no one's ever actually answered this question for me, but do you know what I mean? It's like, who are we to tell a dog that he don't want to hunt that lion?
Well, think about 90% of your animal rights people are cat and dog lovers that have some form of an animal in their home. And if they let that animal be wild for 1 second, it would go back to going to killing its own.
Yeah.
Particularly cats.
Yeah. Like, you don't need to talk the dog into wanting to hunt lions.
Right. They get up in the...
Some just do it.
That's, yeah. No, and that's what really probably the breeding of those dogs is the single most important part, is to breed that drive and desire and those characteristics into them. I'm fortunate enough, a man here in Arizona that's hunted lions his entire life named Steve Smith, and a man that's mentored me is Jim Bueller out of Nevada. Those guys have, the breeding that they've created, I've been the beneficiary of, and it's a game changer for you as a lion hunter to have those genetics that where that dog get, you know, when it's the day it's born, it's almost as though they want to hunt lions.
So you've got dogs that come from generations of dogs that have been selected, like selectively bred for lion hunting.
Decades, 30, 40 years.
Yeah. Were you hunting lions at all during the bounty days when you could get a bounty on lions?
No, that was in the 1960s. I think they late 60s that went away here.
So if you refer to that, they're talking about way ago when you would just
right,
like
way back.
Turn in the scalp on that lion.
Right, and it's And there was guys that, and we still to this day have government guys that are on payroll to do that to protect the livestock industry. You know, some of these lions just, they can wreak havoc. In Nevada, I know Jim Buehler's dealt with, you know, as many as 20 and 30 sheep killed in one evening.
Mm-hmm.
And there's numbers where they're much higher than that, but that's not a crazy thing to see. Julie and I showed up one time and the lion had killed 12 sheep that day.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it just looks like a massacre. And I'm not sure why they do it. You know, I think they just get be like a largemouth bass eating shad. You know, I mean, they just get to kill them.
Did the lion, did you guys catch the lion that killed all those sheep?
We did.
I remember when I was a kid, I used to read Trapper and Predator Caller magazine. I remember an article in there. It was called like the $100,000 lion. And it was because they had done a bighorn sheep transplant.
Oh, yeah.
And then a lion killed all the sheep they transported, and, you know, that they'd brought into this area. I feel like it was in Arizona.
Well, there's been, of course, the brilliance of our game and fish department here to transplant sheep on a mountain called Lion Mountain. This is back in the days when they didn't acknowledge that lions had an effect on sheep, which in the last decade, they have certainly come light years around on that. But even today, we have the Derringers are just world-class lion hunters here in Arizona are working on the Aravaipa sheep herd to preserve it. Another man, Jim Bedlin's done a lot of work. Steve Smith's done a lot of work in Unit 22 here. To bring back those sheep to Jay.
Just trying to take pressure off of...
Remove as much pressure as they could. Typically, they remove the females or what you need to get out of there to get a sheep population to come back.
Mm-hmm.
There's no girls. The boys don't show up for the party.
Yeah.
And the females, when they set up and teach those kittens to kill those sheep, they're just devastating. I know the guys in Nevada, Jim Buehler and Casey Shields, were just working on the Salmon River on the Rockies, removing lions up there this last week. So that's been
for what kind of stuff there? Ag purposes or for wildlife purposes?
No, wildlife purpose. That's all wildlife stuff. That's one thing you really lose is sport. Well, it's very expensive to keep professional lion hunters in business, and we'll always have them as long as we have lions. I mean, in California, they banned sport hunting of lions, and I think they were killing 300 or 400 lions a year.
Yeah, now they kill 300 or 400 do the same thing.
Except we pay to do it. Yeah. And
is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The harvest of lions has never gone down in California. It's just illegal to do it from a sports standpoint now. But from the agriculture standpoint, you know, if you're going to have, going to feed this nation, you have to keep predators from eating the sheep and the cattle. That's just how it is.
Any idea what it costs, you think, to kill 300 or 400 lions in California?
No. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head, but it's, you know, it's a government agency that's functioning and, you can imagine the expense of that, but we'd have them anyway. They deal with a lot of other things. They deal with everything from controlling the waterfowl around airports so we can take off and land our airplane.
Yeah.
You know, deer on the runways at the military bases and, you know, things
but
like that.
Something must have shifted in California, though, because you hear about that the number of cats, the lions are removing through predator control. But then, on the other hand, you hear so many stories about just like the shifting nature of the lion population in California and lions popping up in places they hadn't popped up in before, guys losing more livestock to lions than they used to. So something must be, it must not be that they were going to kill X number and now they're killing the same number anyways, or else you probably wouldn't have these issues.
No, and it's always hard to track actual lion harvest numbers. But one thing that when you are hunting a lion population, you know, especially even if guys are catching them and turning them loose, those lions have a tendency to avoid people.
Mm-hmm.
And these big males, Chris's was, I mean, I think back to yours was probably one of the worst I can remember. But we caught one in New Mexico last year that absolutely, and I can tell when I come up to them whether they're going to be a problem or not. But some of those lions, they're king of the woods. Those big males, they don't wonder if they can kill you. And when you get a lion like that wandering around in some place with children or people that are jogging and not paying attention, if it decides to kill, I think the only reason they don't kill more people is that A, they're upright and they don't correlate that with their normal method of taking prey.
Yeah.
And we probably taste bad. You know, I mean, in comparison to, say, a deer or something they're accustomed to eating. But we've certainly lost people. I mean, and every year, you know, Colorado seems to be having more interaction than anybody these days.
Petite female joggers.
Oh.
And then young kids. It seems
those are the
So it's like some, it is like there's some kind of like visual thing, and often like the thing with like people running.
Well, I think the reaction of those two types of people are where a man may stand his ground or at least not, at least think not to just turn and run. Children, it's hard to convey that to them.
Mm.
You know, they're just probably, they're scared and they're going to run. And even if the cat wasn't, cats are very instinctive. They're just like house cats. Lions are overgrown, great big version of a house cat. And if something runs from it, they just go into that predatory mode.
But when you factor like how many lions there are, it's kind of shocking. And like how many there are and that they have the capability to kill people, it's shocking that it just doesn't happen.
Doesn't happen more. And I always tell people, you know, here in Arizona, it used to be typical for people to hunt a lifetime and see a lion. Now with everybody doing so much more optics hunting, they tend to see a lot more with the optics than they used to.
Yeah.
But I always told people, I said, well, don't ever wonder if one has seen you. You know, I don't know how many times we've ridden by where a lion was laid up and come back the next day and trailed it. You know, and realize that son of a gun was right there.
Oh, is that right?
You know, let us ride by, and maybe it was asleep, maybe it was watching us, who knows, but it was 500 yards up on the side of the mountain in the bluffs watching us probably.
Yeah, not to digress a little bit, but just a point you were talking about with lion harvest and lion predation. And Floyd pointed this out to me, and I think it's genius in the process. The thought process is that, you know, we're hunting lions, but we don't control coyotes near as well as we used to with the banning of trapping in most states and the banning of poison in all states. You know, so a lion goes out and a lion kills a deer, an average, it needs an average of one deer a week. Well, a lion goes out and kills a deer. Well, now our coyote population's out of control. The coyotes come along, find the kill, eat it before the lion can even get a belly full practically. Now, all of a sudden, that lion's back hunting again.
Oh,
you know, so
yeah.
Instead of killing one deer a week, he's maybe killing two or three just to meet his needs.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, a state like California, we're killing, we used to kill 300 with sport hunting. Now we're killing 300 with government hunters. But I got to believe if we were controlling coyote populations, that 300 was a lot more significant number back then than it is now.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, because the coyotes are just basically forcing the deer to hunt, I mean, the lion to hunt.
Interesting. Since we've had that conversation, I saw a study the other day where they've documented that with the wolves. The same scenario.
Did they get the grizzlies steal their...
The wolves steal the lion kills.
Oh, wolves steal lion kills.
Yeah. And they pirate them. Which, you know, there's a lot of things going on that are always hard. It's a very dynamic process when you try and figure out how lions engage the prey species. But there's always a lot of moving parts to it, too. And the coyote deal is a real significant problem here. They've taken some steps here to try and manage them in certain places, but it's definitely where our fawn crop is really, really getting hammered here.
Losing them to that. There was a video clip that came out of Washington where a deer was wearing a collar camera. And they have the footage from this where, because he's like, it's just like sort of, it's sort of like the camera's hanging down where like the tags on a dog would hang down. And you can see the deer, he's just browsing. And when a lion comes and kills it, the lion comes directly on that thing. Doesn't come from behind, doesn't jump from a tree. It's just all of a sudden there's a lion running directly at this deer.
Wow.
And that deer's just dead in seconds.
Yeah. Oh, they're extremely effective killers.
But he just came, like, just at it, you know?
And typically, I would say that they kind of ride up on him from behind and try and...
Oh, wouldn't you think that that'd be how you do it? This guy just is like, all of a sudden, there he is.
Head on it.
Head on, you know? And you got the feeling he'd done it before, you know?
And, you know, some of those big males and any lion, their strength... pound for pound is just unbelievable. To me, I've seen them flip dogs distances with, I'm not even sure I saw quite how the dog got slung so far. And their strength is amazing. And to watch them leap up onto some bluffs and they just explode and fly through the air. I refer back to the house cat, you know, you watch a house cat, it's nothing for them to leap up on the, you know, side of the, any piece of furniture, anything they decide to. That's how those lions are, just on, you know, tenfold that.
Yeah.
You ever been scratched by a lion?
No, I haven't. Although Joe got bit 2 years ago, and that was a complete fiasco. our girls had shot the lion with a 38 special, and it came out of the tree, and the dogs were mauling. It was a, you know, kind of the normal problem. The lion, when Joe stepped in there to try and grab one of his dogs, the lion got a hold of his jeans and just, I mean, one just jerked on him a little bit and jerked his leg out from under him, and then just bit him in the right here in the calf, and then proceeded to just claw its way up him. And that was and I had a pretty big old oak limb that I always get a stick when we're about to shoot one. Anyhow, I went to hitting that thing, and I couldn't get it off of him. But when I hit it, it would quit going up him, other than it was, and it bit him. It only bit him really hard the one time. And I remember the last time I swung at that thing, I remember thinking, if I miss this lion, I'll break his femur in half. And I hit the lion in the head, and it turned around and came after me. And I had a pistol too, so it was, you know, kind of the end of the story there. But it was a painful experience for him. I mean, it punched some holes in him.
Did you have to do much of
staples?
Shots, like any kind of shots for that?
Well, you've met Joe, so you can imagine. I mean, it was all we could do to get him to take some antibiotics. He was kind of, thought it was kind of a cool deal. He'd bleeding all over the place. Yeah, that's really the only one where I've been involved in somebody getting hurt.
You know, the first lion I ever saw, I was coming back from trout fishing on this lake, and I'm driving, it's just after dark, and I'm driving like on a, where a road's cut into a steep hillside, and all of a sudden all these whitetails are like coming down the grade in just like a cloud of dust and kind of like plopping down into the road in front of me. But like they're spooked, rather than being spooked from me,
they're going towards you.
They're spooking from something, almost like running into my my van and the headlights. But then the road was so sheer on the side that they sort of shuffle, trying to stay on the road without going over the ledge. They sort of shuffle along, like right alongside the door of the vehicle. And I roll my window down and put it in reverse to turn the rear lights on, because I'm trying to see what they're doing. And I roll the window down, put the backup lights on, and standing just feet off my bumper is a lion standing there.
Oh, wow.
Like, I have no idea what I drove into or what the situation was as I came around the corner, and I, like, tried, like, to piece it together in my head, but there's no way to explain, like, how everyone got in the position they were in when I hit him with those lights.
You probably did a double take.
Yeah, I was like, he's like, hold on, now what? Like, there's a van here now? Yeah,
probably thinking, thank God for that truck.
No, it was just the weird. Yeah, it was the weirdest thing, man. He's just like standing there in the backup lights, like, yeah, like he's trying to kill one around me. So now, if you've been you hunt lions in Arizona and New Mexico. Now, what prevents you from just taking your lion hunting operation and going to like the next frontier of lion hunting?
Well, I think we're probably in it here. I think there's probably more opportunity. Nothing prevents you from doing that. You can travel and go.
But you think that, like, but you feel like this is still, like, a good, for now, even,
yeah, with
like, a good place to be a lion hunter.
Yeah, so it's not nearly as good as it was 5 years ago or even 10 years ago. Somewhere in there we peaked out, and it's been declining ever since, but it's one of the greatest places there is, because here we, you know, it snows in the high country every year consistently, but there's always lots of wilderness areas and pockets that these lions can move out of, that so you have a constant regeneration of most areas.
Mm-hmm.
And with that said, this year is the first time we've seen places where there's no lions in certain spots. And that's, you know, concerning to everybody that likes to hunt lions here in Arizona right now.
What do you attribute that to? I mean, in the last 5 years, it's not like there's been like a great, you know, influx of lion hunters.
Well, there's been more.
Is that right?
A lot more people have gotten, you know, I every day hear somebody that's a lion hunter that I've never met and never heard of. Whereas 10, 15, 20 years ago, I kind of knew everybody that did it very much. And the biggest thing that I think is a factor now is the mechanization. When people used to have to ride mules and that was the primary way to do it, it was limited. It's limiting in itself to just to have the livestock, so not everybody did it. But now with the four-wheelers, I see a lot of guys that wouldn't be effective normally that are very, very effective because they'll drive on their four-wheelers till they find a track, just like they were hunting in the snow, and then they'll
find a track in the dust.
Right, in the dust. And that seems to have really increased the harvest of lions. And with that said, our lion harvest has not changed significantly. Arizona's harvested between 200 and 300 lions for, you know, well over a decade.
Oh, I got you. So something else is going on that's...
Yeah, and I'm not...
Like you were talking about earlier, like something with like a cycle with the
prey base. You know, and our deer herd's been in a decline for a decade anyway.
Yeah.
Maybe two decades.
Yeah.
And possibly everything's just reaching that point where the predators are following it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really hard to say. And this is, you know, the first time I've ever felt like our lion numbers were low. And it's not, I don't think that there's much that could be done to change it one way or the other if you want to increase it or decrease it more. It's just a natural thing, and a natural peaks and valleys of wildlife.
Yeah. What's the next favorite food after deer for a mountain lion, not counting domestic?
Javelina here.
It's number two.
Yeah. It'd probably go deer, calves, javelina. You know, in the spring around here, they can just be deadly on these calves.
When we were out, we found where one had killed a fox.
Well, a fox and a deer? And didn't
yeah, we found a dead deer, yeah.
Didn't we find a calf kill at one, an old calf kill?
I don't remember that. I remember if like one had just like ripped the fox up.
And that's kind of where...
You saw where they've eaten tortoises or turtles?
Right.
Turtles or tortoises?
Desert tortoises.
Desert tortoises, yeah.
I happened to be riding along with Matt Pierce, who was conducting this study in the Harquahalers and the Harquabars at the time. We were actually in the Hualapai Mountains and rode up where a lion had killed a desert tortoise and actually left a scratch right there by it.
Really?
Broke the shell off of it, bit, you know, down and then busted the shell and then probably jerked the turtle out through the hole and then actually scratched just like he'd killed a deer. And left that turtle. And what was crazy was...
He ate the meat off the turtle.
Yeah.
He pulled the meat free.
It was just a shell there. And Matt actually still, I'm sure he still has the shell. What was interesting was we were riding that day discussing the fact that a biologist, a lady by the name of Jenny Cashman, she was with the U of A at the time, and she had just finished doing the fecal exam, they collected a bunch of scats up, and they were finding tortoise feet in there. And Matt had asked me, he said, do you think they eat turtles? I said, oh, they eat everything else.
Like, what all have you seen when you're tracking them? What all have you seen that they've killed?
I can't think of anything that lives in Arizona that I haven't seen that they've killed. Badgers, skunks.
Bear?
Bears.
Black bear?
Eagles. They were cubs, you know.
Yeah.
Young bears. Elk. Lots of sheep. Mostly deer. Everything. I just cannot think of a species. Antelope. We had one, it was last year or the year before, killed an antelope right up here by Sunset Point. And I think they can kill anything they want to. It's just a matter of whether they decide to do it or not.
You said you've seen where they've killed eagles.
Yeah. Yep. And that was on one of their kills.
Oh, he came down. I was wondering, like, well, how he caught what the eagle was doing. With the eagle just eating something.
Yeah, it was. I mean, somehow the lion. Of course, they birds. You know, cats catch birds all the time. I guess the lion, you know, was probably laying right there when that eagle was eating on it, and just took him out too.
Did he eat the eagle?
Yeah, he ate the breast out of it.
Really?
I remember looking at that when we rode up, thinking, oh,
I didn't like that at
all. I didn't want to get any credit for that at all.
Burrows.
Burrows? They eat the wild burrows?
They do.
Yeah, you don't see that very often, but they'll kill these wild burrows once in a while.
Yeah.
Not enough of them, but...
Not enough of them.
As we train lions to kill burrows, we could solve a lot of problems.
Yeah, turn those lions loose.
Yeah man, that's a whole issue for a future conversation.
Yeah.
That would be good. I would love to have that conversation.
On the burrow?
Just about, yeah.
Yeah.
What to do about it.
We need to not have it when Julie's around if we're going to transfer it to the wild horse population.
I just refuse to Like I don't like the argument of people who say they should be treated like a native animal.
They're not.
Because like somehow during like the Eocene, they were here and then, you know, like millions of years ago, or that because the Spanish brought them here, they should be treated as a native species because the Spanish brought pigs.
They're feral livestock.
Yeah.
The end of the day, they're feral livestock. And these horse lovers can make all the arguments they want to about that. But they're a non-native species in feral livestock. And how we have the Wild Horse and Burro Act boggles my mind. And it is it's devastating the habitat.
That's what I would think. I would think any time you have a conflict between feral livestock and native wildlife, I can't believe there's even a debate about who's going to take precedence.
And even if you took the wildlife out of the scope of it, the damage that can be done through the overgrazing, the same people that want to run every cow off the land think it's okay to let the burros and the horses destroy it.
Graze it, yeah. Next time, ladies and gentlemen, on Meat Eater Podcast.
Yeah.
We're going to take on the issue of wild burros. You guys call them burros?
Burros. That's what I call them.
Yeah. It's a wild horse.
No, we have burros.
Burros here too. Donkeys.
Like full-on wild donkeys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they're probably worse than the horses.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
How many of them roam Arizona?
In the thousands.
Really?
Yeah. They're really bad in desert sheep country because they'll just get into a water hole and just own it. They won't let anything come and drink. They'll just hang out there for days. Anything that comes into it.
When you said that, I just automatically thought you meant like Mustangs.
No, we have more horses here now than we ever did due to the big fires that we had. A lot of domestic horses got loose, and then we had the economic downturn. A lot of people turned horses loose here.
Yeah,
but
and also when they shut down the horse slaughter facilities.
Yeah, right.
You know, caused that. I remember I was talking to a stock detective. I wrote a story about livestock theft some years ago. And one of the stock detectives was saying that there used to be a horse theft problem, and now we have the opposite problem, where people are always waking up to find horses they do not want inside their fence. Where instead of trying to go get a horse, you're always trying to go get rid of a horse. You'll
find a place to put them.
All right, thank you for tuning in. We will solve the wild horse, wild burro dilemma next time on the Meat Eater Podcast.
This show is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. It is a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that they need and that meets them where they are and helps them get through challenges. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible. It's simple to use. You can connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.